Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, new intelligence helps explain why a changing Al-Qaeda remains so lethal and is likely to stay that way.
The AARP, under fire from many of its own members for supporting the Medicare reform bill, explains.
We think that if it's not done this year, it would actually be several more years with no assurance that we would get a better result.
We remember JFK with a journalist who knew both the president and his assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald.
And Halle Berry's new film, Gothica.
Are you scared? No. You should be. But should you see it?
We'll find out.
These stories and more are coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Supporters of the massive new energy bill have failed to end debate in the Senate, and that's delayed a final vote on the measure. The House passed the bill earlier this week, but NPR's David Wellner tells us why some senators are opposing it.
There was one element in the bill that many considered the poison pill, and that was a provision that was inserted after both the House and Senate had voted on their own versions of the bill that would protect the producers of the fuel additive MTBE from liability lawsuits. This is something that representatives had insisted on in the House, Republicans, but that some states, especially in the Northeast, said would block lawsuits that are needed to compensate people for the damage they suffered.
NPR's David Wellness speaking to us from Capitol Hill. Jurors are now deliberating the punishment for convicted Washington, D.C. area sniper John Alad Mohammed. NPR's Ann Hawk reports from Virginia Beach.
It's been nearly 6 weeks of jury service, hearing testimony and seeing graphic photos. And now the 12 jurors, seven women and five men from the area of Virginia Beach, Virginia, hold Mohammed's life in their hands. In closing arguments, prosecutors argued Mohammed's crimes are proof of a depraved mind, and his actions show he's a continuing danger and must be put to death. Defense lawyers acknowledged the horror of the shootings in this case, but told jurors, choosing life over death doesn't excuse these crimes. It only means you found compassion. The judge sent jurors off to deliberate with more than a dozen pages of instructions and verdict forms, and now they must decide whether Mohammed will get life in prison without parole or the death penalty. Ann Hawk, NPR News, Virginia Beach, Virginia.
President Bush has wrapped up his three-day state visit to the United Kingdom with a tour of Prime Minister Blair's home district of Sedgefield. NPR's Don Gagne reports.
Sedgefield is a village about an hour's flight north of London. The president's final day in the United Kingdom included a visit to a school and this lunch at a country pub called the Dun Cow Inn.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, my honor.
The president and Prime Minister Blair shook hands and made small talk with locals who'd been invited to meet Mr. Bush. But the president's escape to the British countryside did not mean he would be free of protesters. About 300 demonstrators gathered in the village square carrying signs critical of the president and his policies in Iraq and chanting anti-Bush slogans. The president arrives back in Washington tonight. Don Gagne, NPR News, near Sedgefield in northeast England.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 3 points to 96.22. Trading has been moderate. The Nasdaq is up 7 points to 1890, and the S&P 500 is up a fraction. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Interior Department unveils plans today for opening nearly 9 million acres of Alaska's North Slope to oil and gas development. None of the land is part of the Alaskan Wildlife Refuge. The Interior Department says the leases will allow drilling in large sites while protecting sensitive areas. But environmentalists say it will threaten the lakes and Arctic tundra that provide sanctuary for wildlife and migratory birds. Krispy Kreme Donuts is reporting another strong quarter and more expansion. From member station WFAE in Charlotte, Scott Jagar reports.
North Carolina-based Krispy Kreme says third-quarter earnings rose 43%, about what analysts expected. The strong quarter was fueled by a nearly 30% increase in sales. The company says sales would have been even higher had it not been for Hurricane Isabel, grocery store strikes, and unseasonably warm weather late in the quarter. Still, the strong sales helped boost profits to 23 cents a share from 17 cents a share a year earlier. Krispy Kreme opened 27 new stores in the third quarter, continuing its aggressive expansion in the U.S., Canada, and elsewhere. The company expects fourth quarter earnings of about 26 cents a share. For NPR News, I'm Scott Jagow in Charlotte.
ExxonMobil has settled a dispute with the Internal Revenue Service. The Texas-based oil giant says it will get a tax refund and interest of about $2.2 billion. That's worth more than half of the company's profit in last year's fourth quarter. The dispute centered on tax deductions claimed by Exxon on the sale of natural gas between 1974 and 1990. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces the I Heard It on NPR box set, three CDs of music by artists who have been featured on NPR programs at npr.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Insurgents struck at the heart of Baghdad today, firing rockets from donkey-drawn carts. Their targets, the Iraqi oil ministry and the Palestine and Sheraton hotels, where many journalists and U.S. workers are staying. No one was killed. Two more rocket launchers, both unfired, were found atop donkey carts after the attacks, one near the Italian embassy and the other near the Academy of Fine Arts. Freelance journalist Catherine Arnold was staying just across the street from the Palestine Hotel. She was one of the first to arrive at the scene.
It was amazingly quiet because the bomb actually struck at 7:15 this morning. So almost everyone in the area, it's a highly residential area surrounded by hotels and shops. None of the shops were actually open, and obviously most people in their hotels were asleep. So the actual scene was remarkably desolate. When I arrived, I was one of about 10 people there, and the only thing to actually be seen was the donkey who had been pulling the cart, which had the grenades, and the remains of the cart itself. As soon as the attack happened, people began to muster outside the two hotels, gathering in the foyer downstairs, and a few were clustering outside. Shortly afterwards, some barbed wire was pulled across the road, and the Iraqi police arrived, and shortly after that, some additional coalition forces arrived at the scene.
Journalist Catherine Arnold from Baghdad.
There were several arrests in Turkey today following a bombing of a British bank and the British consulate in Istanbul yesterday. Details were not released by the Turkish government about these arrests, but Al-Qaeda is widely believed to be responsible. Though hunted from one end of the world to the other, Al-Qaeda remains lethal and seems to be transforming itself. The Boston Globe's Brian Bender has been following new intelligence on the evolution of Al-Qaeda, and he now joins me on the line from Washington. Welcome, Brian.
Good morning.
You write in today's Boston Globe that before the U.S. war in Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda had more of a corporate structure. How's it organized today?
Well, I think the main difference is that since the U.S. war on terrorism, the invasion of Afghanistan, the Al-Qaeda network has been forced to go into hiding, if you will. They can't operate like they used to, having meetings, planning terrorist attacks in Afghanistan primarily. So what's happened, according to intelligence officials, is the leadership, which is smaller and less numerous as it used to be, is now relying on more local militant groups in places like Turkey, as we saw yesterday and elsewhere, to basically freelance, to go out on their own, to try and launch whatever attacks they might be able to, rather than the old model, which was much more authorization planning that would come from the top.
Yeah, there were three top leaders and eight senior commanders, you write, at the time of the bombing of Afghanistan. Now one of the three top leaders is dead, and
right,
five of the eight senior commanders have been killed or captured. So who's calling the shots?
Well, I think everyone would agree that bin Laden himself and Ayman Zawahiri, who is his number two, an Egyptian doctor, are still at the head of the network. But again, it's been so difficult for them to communicate with cells around the world. So what you have are some lower-level commanders, if you will, that are out there in the world in different geographic areas, they're kind of taking up the standard on their own.
Now, what about Wahhabism, the fundamentalist strain of Islam that originated in Saudi Arabia and that inspires many in Al-Qaeda? Has Al-Qaeda become not so much a group as an idea?
Well, I think many would argue that it always was an idea more than it was an established terrorist group where you could actually map it out, who are the leaders, who are the followers. And I think even Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has weighed in on that, basically acknowledging that it's very hard to know whether or not we're just a hamster running around a wheel. In other words, we're killing a lot of terrorists, we're taking them off the streets, but are other young men primarily going into these religious schools and coming out the other end ready to fight holy war? So the big question is, can you shut off the faucet, if you will?
Brian Bender is a reporter for the Boston Globe who follows terrorism-related issues. Brian, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
As things stand now, a bill reforming Medicare should be completed by Thanksgiving. Some conservative legislators don't like it, saying costs will balloon in the next 10 years. Some liberal legislators don't like it, saying the bill is specifically designed to destroy Medicare altogether. But the AARP, an advocacy group for retired people, threw its support behind the bill and has come under heavy fire. In fact, some of the group's members have burned their membership cards. Marie Coco is a syndicated columnist. She joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome, Marie.
Thank you.
You also weighed in on this issue. Your thoughts?
I think this is about the worst. It's not quite the worst bill that could have emerged from the conference, but it's certainly right up there. This bill is not any kind of triumph for elderly people. Taken as a whole, the biggest beneficiary of this bill is the pharmaceutical industry, which wanted two things out of Washington. It wanted the drug benefit passed, but it also wanted no price controls. It did not want the government to be able to do what Walmart does every day, which is use its power as the biggest consumer of an item, the biggest purchaser, to lower prices.
Well, Marie, given that, your thoughts on the AARP backing the bill?
I was shocked that the AARP backed the bill, because all along the AARP had said that if the final bill included steps to privatize Medicare, to weaken it by handing it over, handing the social insurance program over to the private insurance industry, the organization would oppose it.
AARP Chief William Novelli says that this compromise was a way of making everyone happy, saving Medicare, and that it was this or nothing.
Well, it's not a way to save Medicare. Now, I think it might be true at the moment that it's this drug bill or nothing, but the question that arises in my mind is, if you are, for example, a Democrat, or if you are the AARP and your goal is to get a good drug benefit, why does it have to be done right now? Why can't you force the White House and the Republican Congress to do it next year in the middle of an election year? And then maybe when people are paying even more attention than they are now, you could come up with a better bill.
Do you share the same...
White House needs this more than the Democrats do.
Do you share the same concern as others? I'm thinking of Paul Krugman in his column today, that one of the problems is that AARP has become a small business.
Well, it certainly is a small business, and I know that a number of other writers have pointed out the amount of revenue that the group gets from various insurance products that it already sells, would presumably sell more insurance products once this legislation passes.
Do you think, as some do, that AARP has, in essence, sold out its members?
That's what I'm hearing from the members. Now, I hear from members all over the country because my column is syndicated. Mostly so far, I have heard from people in the New York metropolitan region, which tends to read my column first. I have not gotten a single piece of favorable feedback about the AARP since they took this decision. I think at the very, very least, they have split their membership badly. I think they're going to become known to elderly people as nothing more than a lobby group for itself.
Marie Coco, thank you.
Thank you.
Marie Coco, a nationally syndicated columnist. She sits on the editorial board of Newsday. We turn now to John Rother, policy director of AARP. He's also in Washington. John, I know you want to respond, first of all, to the claim that this has been tried before and it failed.
I think that's an area that we agree on, because HMOs have not proved very successful in the Medicare marketplace. What's different about this bill is they're going to try to encourage PPOs, the kind of insurance that most working Americans have, and see if they can be any more successful. And so it's an experiment. I don't think we know how it's going to work. I'm skeptical myself. But it's a way to get support that we need for a very important prescription drug bill.
But why does it have to happen now? As Marie and others have said, why can't you wait? It won't take effect till 2006 anyway. So why, as some perceive it, ram it through?
Well, we've been working on this for 5 years. We had votes that were unsuccessful last year because of it being an election year. And everyone we've talked to in the Congress believes that nothing can happen next year that will require bipartisan cooperation. So we're having a hard enough time this year doing it, and we think that if it's not done this year, it would actually be several more years with no assurance that we would get a better result. Mm-hmm. So the time really is now, and this is the culmination of a multi-year effort.
I'm sure you've read Paul Krugman's column from this morning, and you know, he makes the point that if AARP stands to benefit from having a relationship, commission relationship, with prescription drug companies or insurance companies, then you'd want to back legislation that means you'd benefit from that relationship.
Well, nothing could be further than the truth. In fact, we've consistently backed expansions of Medicare that would cut back on our income from the sale of Medigap policies. And we are in favor of eliminating the need for private supplementary insurance, if there's any way to do that. So I think it's particularly misleading to make that kind of a claim when our record for the past 20 years has been very consistent and very public.
Well, how do you plan to deal with the so-called Trojan horses? The way some people see this bill is that it has these side effects. For instance, sending people over to private insurers would mean that only the oldest and the sickest would still remain on Medicare, and as the youngest of the elderly are lured to these private insurers, and that means that the premiums for the oldest and sickest would go through the roof.
That's very much a concern of ours. There's something called risk adjustment, which is a way of paying more to Medicare and less to a private plan if that plan only enrolls younger and healthier people. And it's a way of keeping the competition fair so that the traditional Medicare program would not be penalized. And so that's been absolutely key to our decision to go forward with support for a drug benefit, because we absolutely are committed to the integrity of the traditional Medicare program.
John, your organization has done a poll showing that 75% of the members of AARP that you polled approved of the bill and wanted it passed. Are you worried when you send out that little notice to people as they approach 50 saying, welcome to AARP? Are you worried that that at least the perception in the general public seems to be that AARP has turned their back on the elderly? Are you worried about the organization's future?
I'm not worried about the organization's future, but I do think that one consequence of being a leader and being an advocate is that sometimes you do things that people are upset with, and I think that's inherent in the job that we take on. And so I'm sure that it will cost us some members, and I'm sure it will cost us quite a bit of money. But we think we're doing the right thing for our members and for the future of Medicare, so we're certainly prepared to do it.
John, thank you.
You're welcome.
John Rother, Policy Director for AARP.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters at HERE-NOW.ORG.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Please tell us how to pronounce your name and tell us the town you're from.
Just ahead, our film review. It's a thriller, but will it thrill you?
And later in the show, our editorial roundtable weigh in on Rush Limbaugh, gay marriage, and the royal footman who got a foot in the door of Buckingham Palace.
There's more coming up here and now. ¶¶ I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In the new film Gothica, Academy Award-winning actress Halle Berry plays Dr. Miranda Gray, a criminal psychiatrist with a well-ordered life, a job at a prison psychiatric ward run by her husband, Doug. But while talking to Doug on the cell phone, on a car trip home, on a rainy night, life takes a startling turn.
Doug! Doug!
Well, what follows transforms Miranda from Dr. Gray to psychiatric patient Gray. And joining us now with her diagnosis of the new film, Gothica, is Here and Now film critic Renee Graham. Welcome, Renee.
Hi, Bill.
Great to see you. It sounds spooky. What happens after that beginning? Is it any good?
It's not very good. Ooh. I mean, it's got this title, you know, like it sounds like it should belong to a Norwegian death metal band.
It does.
And at times the movie is so loud, you actually think that's what you're listening
to. The clip
to.
Was loud.
The clip is loud. There's lots of loud music and crashes. But really, this is a lurid and incredibly silly supernatural thriller with Halle
Berry.
Well,
not necessarily all bad.
Not all bad, but it's just, it's the kind of movie where you not only have to suspend belief, you have to send it on an extended vacation to a deserted island. And that's still not enough. Halle Berry plays, as you mentioned, a psychiatrist who's accused of hacking her husband, Charles S. Dutton, to death. Mm. And as the movie goes on, she ends up as a patient in the very hospital where she once worked. And in the clip we're going to hear, she's learning from Robert Downey Jr., who's her co-worker and also a psychiatrist, why she's now at this hospital.
Was there any trouble in your marriage?
No, there was no trouble in my marriage, no. And why are you using the past tense of the word?
Miranda, well, you don't remember anything about Doug. Anything at all.
No, don't tell me there's something wrong with Doug.
I have to tell you something.
Please don't tell me there's something wrong with Doug.
Miranda, Doug is dead. You killed him.
Robert Downey Jr. and Halle Berry in Gothica. Now, Renee, this is Halle Berry's first real starring role since her Academy Award-winning film, Monster's Ball. How does she do?
It's a terrible choice. I mean, she's been in two other films, or at least two other films have been released since she won for Monster's Ball, X2, the sequel to X-Men, and also Die Another Day, the last James Bond film. But this is her first above-the-title starring role. She's expected to carry this film, and she's in pretty much every frame of the movie, but there's just nothing to it. I mean, it's a very physically demanding role. She actually broke her arm during one of the scenes, but there's nothing for her to do really as an actress but to sort of scream and to run and it just doesn't hold up. And I'm not really sure what about this script, other than the fact that she was probably paid a lot of money for it, you know, helped her decide to do it.
How about the other performances, especially Robert Downey Jr., of course, has had his ups and downs.
Robert Downey Jr., who I think really is a good actor, isn't really important in this movie. Anyone could have played this role. He just, you know, he's sort of there. He's kind of mailing it in. It's sort of a very standard, you know, probably a substandard Robert Downey Jr. performance. And Penelope Cruz is also in the film, and she plays a psychiatric patient, Chloe, who is being counseled by Miranda. And then, because Miranda is sent to the same facility where she was once a psychiatrist, has, you know, meets with Miranda later on.
You know I don't belong here, Chloe.
Oh, if you're here, it must mean that you belong. You are not a doctor in here.
And even if you tell the truth,
no one will listen.
You know why?
Because you're crazy. The more you try to prove them wrong, the crazier you'll appear. You are invisible now. Can you feel it?
It finally got a little quiet.
Oh, but by this point, you're just in the movie and you watch and just like, oh, whatever. Let's just get to the point. And I could forgive all this if the movie were actually scary.
Oh.
But it's not. There are, you know, more unintentional laughs, such as trying to believe that Halle Berry would be married to Charles S. Dutton. And no disrespect, but, you know, brother, please, okay? But there aren't any really truly scary moments. You see everything coming. And, you know, it's the kind of movie where, you know, Halle Berry sees dead people. But what I kept seeing were the ghosts of far better films.
Renee Graham on the new Halle Berry vehicle, Gothica. Renee, thanks so much for your candid opinions.
You're welcome, Bill.
We've been talking about the film Gothica, which opens today.
I'm not telling lies, but my dreams, they aren't as empty as my conscience seems to be.
Well, there are seven new immortals now to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Yesterday, among those named were Bob Seger, Prince, Jackson Browne, and the late George Harrison. Although Harrison was already enshrined in the hall in Cleveland on the banks of Lake Erie as a member of the band he started out with. The new accolade, of course, comes for Harrison's solo work. And it comes at a time when the Beatles are in another of their perpetual resurgences with the release of the Beatles' famed appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show. And there's a new book of criticism and several new recordings. Perhaps the most anticipated CD being Let It Be Naked. That re-engineered version of the original Let It Be album, Naked, is said by some, most notably Paul McCartney himself, to be closer to the album's original intent, now that the embellishments of Wall of Sound producer and now alleged murderer Phil Spector have been stripped away. Well, we talked to our pop and rock music critic and Beatles guru Tim Riley about his take on the new album.
I think that the inspiration for it and the concept of the record is actually really good, and it ties in with the original concept of the production as they started out. What I don't like about the Let It Be Naked project is that it's not really naked. In other words, there's a lot of overdubbing that's been added to these sessions, and there's a lot of cleaning up that's happened.
Next week, we'll have a conversation with Tim about all the latest Beatles offerings.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Let it be, let it be.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, our editorial roundtable takes on matters of the past week. Rush Limbaugh, gay marriage, and that sneaky reporter who got hired by the Queen.
Also, the 40th anniversary of the assassination of JFK. An author, the only person who knew both the president and his killer, reflects.
When I heard Lee Harvey, I knew the rest of the name. But how many Lee Harveys do you know?
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. That massive energy bill before Congress has been stopped in its tracks on a 57-40 vote. Supporters failed by 3 votes to cut off Senate debate on the measure. The House passed it earlier this week. Republicans are vowing to bring the legislation back. Opponents argue that the $31 billion measure, crafted largely in closed-door Republican negotiations with the House, was too expensive and amounted to a collection of subsidies to special interest. 6 Republicans joined Democrats in opposing the bill. Jury deliberations are underway in the sentencing phase of convicted sniper John Muhammad's trial. The panel of 7 women and 5 men is the same one that convicted Muhammad on Monday. They are now deciding whether he should be executed or sent to prison for the rest of his life. Meanwhile, prosecutors in the trial of the other man charged with Muhammad in connection with last year's shooting spree in the Washington, D.C. area are expected to rest their case today. The first witness this morning, an FBI expert, testified that DNA evidence links teenager Lee Boyd Malvo to several of the sniper shooting scenes. More American deaths are reported in Iraq. The military says a U.S. soldier from the 82nd Airborne Division was killed, 2 others injured west of Baghdad when a roadside bomb went off next to their convoy yesterday. And U.S. officials say another soldier was killed yesterday in northern Iraq. Colorful donkey carts, which are common sights on the streets of Baghdad, are now being searched to see if any more are carrying rocket launchers. More than a dozen rockets were lobbed at 2 hotels and the Iraqi Oil Ministry building from carts in a sign of defiance against a recent U.S. military crackdown. 1 injury was reported. The United States will use a ceremony Monday to repatriate remains believed to be of Americans reported missing in Laos during the Vietnamese War, including those of the brother of Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean. Charles Dean was a University of North Carolina graduate student traveling through Southeast Asia when he and a companion disappeared. The 2 are believed to have been taken prisoner and killed by Laotian communist forces who took control of the country in 1975. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are higher. The Dow is up 8 points at 96.28. The Nasdaq is up 9 points at 18.91. The S&P 500 is up a point at 10.35.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
From President Bush in London amid royalty and 100,000 protesters to Rush Limbaugh's return to the airwaves and his millions of loyal ditto heads to gay marriage in Massachusetts. What a week it's been for our editorial roundtable to contemplate. Here are some voices from the week that was, starting with the editor of the Daily Mirror. One of his reporters managed to get hired by Buckingham Palace for 2 months leading up to President Bush's visit there this week.
He was asked to supply each of the presidential rooms with nuts and chocolates and other material, which, of course, had he wanted to, he could have put a package inside or indeed poison.
The Prime Minister, with the support of the Royal Household, is therefore asking the Security Commission to conduct a thorough review.
It's a fantastic thing to come to a country where people are able to express their views.
Why do they hate you in such numbers?
I don't know that they do.
I know the sky probably seems brighter today to you, no matter where you are. The air is cleaner, the water is purer, and it's not because the environmentalist wackos, it's because I'm back. I would have found a way around it. I would have manipulated and lied, whatever it took to get around them. I was addicted.
Today's court decision essentially said
as to both liberty and equality, there is in fact no rational reason whatsoever for this discrimination against gay and lesbian families in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Marriage is an institution between a man and a woman. I will support an amendment to the Massachusetts Constitution to make that expressly clear.
What a week, finishing up with Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney on gay marriage, one of the subjects under consideration now by our editorial roundtable. Joining us on the line are Dorothy Rabinowitz, columnist and editorial board member at The Wall Street Journal in New York City. Hi, Dorothy.
Hello.
And Bill Nemitz, columnist for the Portland Press Herald in Portland, Maine. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Dorothy, let's get started with you. The Queen's been granted an injunction that puts a halt to more revelations from Ryan Perry, that Daily Mirror reporter who got into the palace. This is highly unusual, Dorothy, but a Queen's counselor said that Ryan Parry was in flagrant breach of a confidentiality clause, and he added he was not so much a footman as a foot in the door man.
I think it's wonderful of the Queen. She looks better and better with every passing year. I mean, I think it was absurd to do.
Absurd to do, Dorothy? Didn't it show a major hole in palace security with the President of the United States staying at the palace?
Everything shows a major hole in security if you try hard enough. But this gotcha impulse on the part of the press only succeeds in making it more loathed by the population at large. It is not doing itself any good.
That gotcha impulse again. Bill Nemitz, your thoughts on Mr. Ryan Parry and the Daily Mirror and their stunt?
I agree wholeheartedly. I think undercover press operations always run the risk of blowing up in your face simply because people are going to look at it all, and however titillated they might be, the bottom line conclusion is you shouldn't have been there in the first place.
Bill, what about Bush's visit, his state visit, the first since Woodrow Wilson to Britain? Your thoughts?
Well, the great moment of the week for me when he was talking about how much he loves criticism and how he's not sure that they hate him, and meanwhile they're pulling his statue and effigy down out in the square, it never ceases to amaze me, his ability to kind of look beyond what's happening right in front of him and therefore not see what's happening right in front of him.
But, you know, Dorothy, there was that Guardian newspaper poll, the Guardian, a very left-wing newspaper is how it's usually referred to, reporting that a majority of Britons think America is a force for good in the world, and about half of them were happy to see George Bush in London.
That's true, actually, and it's a little reported, though it is a busy news day, that this highly organized march was, you know, organized by, you know, active communists, the mad mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. I would like to go back to say one thing. Bush was asked, Mr. President, by a British reporter, how is it that so many people hate you? I would have, if I'd been the president, said, up your medication.
But, you know, Dorothy, there are other issues than Iraq and the war. Those British Guantanamo detainees, that's a huge story in England that the U.S. will not release. The steel tariffs that the European Union and the British are furious about, American steel tariffs. You know, it doesn't seem like President Bush gave an inch to Tony Blair either.
Terrific to have a president who won't give an inch when it would have done a world of good politically for him to do so.
Hmm.
I mean, one of the most distinguishing features of this president is his stalwartness in the face of legitimate concerns for safety.
Bill Nemitz?
Well, that's true. But what happens, I think the true test was going to come next November when, because of his actions pertaining to this war and global security in general, it's going to be a referendum on George Bush. And if there is a goal to these demonstrations, I think it's to make him pay by failing in his bid for a second term.
So let me ask you, if we're talking next year, and Bush has been reelected by a whopping majority, what can we conclude?
You know what I'll conclude? The economy took a great turn for the better, and the war didn't matter.
Let's turn quickly to two other subjects we'd love to squeeze into the roundtable today. Just some quick thoughts first from you, Dorothy, on Rush Limbaugh back on the airwaves. And, he's addicted to those drugs and went through a lot with it, he said, but certainly not saying he did anything wrong.
Yes, well, I was overwhelmed by the tone of his first broadcast. This time I tuned in, and I must say he sounded altogether too much like a 20th century product of extreme analysis.
Yeah, he said, I can no longer turn over the power of my feelings to anyone else. Touchy-feely, Rush Limbaugh, Bill Nemeth.
Well, that's about as touchy-feely as he gets. I think the problem, I'm not a regular listener either, but I think his regular listeners will no longer be able to wonder, is that Rush or is that the Oxy talk?
Yeah.
Well, he's also facing some, according to ABC News, he's also facing an investigation for making 30 to 40
right.
withdrawals of just under $10,000 each from a bank. That's a way that people withdraw a lot of money without having to report it. So that may cause him problems,
too. This is all far from over. You know, I mean, he's got the investigation down in Florida to deal with. It's going to be very interesting if Rush Limbaugh becomes more of the focus of a criminal drug investigation, how much that translates into a sudden conspiracy in his eyes to take down Rush Limbaugh.
Dorothy, gay marriage in Massachusetts, it got huge play in some media, but in fact, it turns out a lot of newspapers didn't even editorialize on it around the country. How big a deal?
Well, I don't think it's a big deal. The way it's been prepared in my neighborhood and in New York, everybody I know who is a gay male couple has gone away to be married in Canada or elsewhere. You know, when things begin to happen that way, there is no more shock value. If this had been 15 years ago, you would have seen a lot more fuss, and there isn't any.
Mm-hmm. Bill Nemeth?
I think it's just part of a slow, inexorable process. We'll see where we are 25 years from now.
Yes.
Want to thank you both. Wish we had a little more time. Bill Nemeth, a columnist for the Portland Press-Herald in Portland, Maine. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
And Dorothy Rabinowitz, a columnist and editorial board member at the Wall Street Journal.
Aww.
Thanks a lot, Dorothy.
Right.
Happy Thanksgiving to all.
Oh, you said it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Here and Now. When London's Daily Mirror newspaper reporter Ryan Parry infiltrated Buckingham Palace's inner sanctum over the last month, he exposed something more shocking than a security breach. He exposed an interior decorating nightmare. From the garish green tiles in Prince Edward's bathroom to the pillows in Andrew's sitting room, the seat of Britain's monarchy, it turns out, is more fold-up chair than velvet-embroidered throne. In short, an elaborate decorating faux pas. So in the spirit of that special relationship between the U.S. and U.K., we thought we'd enlist a decorating expert to give the royal family a few tips. Joining us on the line from Montreal is designer Debbie Travis, host of the soon-to-be-seen room makeover show called Facelift. Debbie, welcome.
Well, hi. How are you?
I'm fine. Okay, so you went online and saw these pictures, and we should say that it might be a little harder to get the pictures now because the royal family won an injunction to stop them from being printed. But what jumped out at you?
It's very English traditional, probably what Americans think of as, you know, how most English homes are. But I think a lot of us have moved on since then. It's got a big padded headboard, you know, very 60s, red kind of striped wallpaper, tone on tone, grey carpet. And you can imagine in Buckingham Palace, they probably have gorgeous kind of hardwood floors, but like the 60s, they put, you know, carpet everywhere like we all did.
Now, whose room was this?
This is Andrew's. Andrew's room is, I would say, his bedroom is very, very stark. The thing that hit the press in England is the fact that he has a pillow on there that says Daddy. Now, Prince Andrew is in his 40s, so it's kind of, and you know, and he's a bachelor, remember, and he, you know, he brings girls over. So I guess it's not a very kind of macho bachelor thing to have a pillow that says, you know, Daddy on.
Did he also, I read, have a pillow that says Eat, Drink, and Remarry?
Eat, Sleep, and Remarry, which is, you know, it's a good, living in hope. But I think he just needs a kind of bit of a kind of wave of a magic wand, or, you know, they've got lots of money, you know, hire somebody to come in and give a bit of an update. But he also has, you know, they said he has a state-of-the-art TV, so he's kind of a typical guy. He probably doesn't even notice the decor.
Prince Edward apparently has a wooden wall unit.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It really looks like something we'd all run out, you know, go down to Home Depot to get at the weekend. So he's kind of one of us, I guess, but it's quite Spartan. Andrew's is kind of old-fashioned lavish, you know, but now tatty, scruffy. Whereas Edward's is really looks like they took the basement furniture and shoved it in his bedroom.
And, of course, the poor queen, Her Majesty's breakfast table had little plastic yogurt containers and Tupperwares of cereal. But, you know,
I remember my grandmother used to have Tupperwares of, you know, cereal by her bedside, so...
Yeah. Well, you know, I think what's kind of sad about the whole thing is that, you know, they are really like us all. You know, we all expect absolutely some fabulous mansion with the, you know, the state of the art, the most expensive things possible. But like she said, she probably eats her yogurt out of a plastic carton. I mean, how many of us put our yogurt into a silver bowl every morning?
Yeah.
That's maybe what we want them to do. But I think they in privacy, they live just like us.
Debbie, thank you.
Thank you.
Debbie Travis's Facelift, a decorating makeover show, premieres January 1st on HGTV.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
If you meet a refined, gray-haired woman named Priscilla McMillan in Harvard Square, do not mistake her gentleness for lack of conviction. Priscilla is a fierce community activist, a highly respected scholar at the Davis Center for Russian Studies at Harvard, and the only person who knew both John F. Kennedy and Lee Harvey Oswald.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine. I have some tea on.
We recently visited Priscilla in her home to talk over tea about her work as a speechwriter for then-Senator John Kennedy in the 50s, about their well-documented dating friendship. He pursued, she declined. And about how, as a reporter in Moscow in 1959, she met a 20-year-old American defector named Lee Harvey Oswald.
Well, I had heard that there was a young defector staying in my hotel and that he wouldn't speak to anybody at the American embassy. A consular officer told me that, but he said to me, well, maybe he'll talk to you because you're a woman. I found out which room he lived on. He lived just below me in the hotel, and he said, yes, he'd come up and talk to me that night in my room. He carefully stood in the door of his room so I wouldn't be able to see inside.
Priscilla would come to learn that she and Oswald were both paying only $3 a day for their rooms. He, because he'd attempted suicide and the Soviets didn't know what to do with him. She, because the Russians wanted to recruit her to be a spy. There is a cottage industry in the U.S. of conspiracy theorists who believe Priscilla McMillan was a spy for the U.S. because she was a stringer for an agency seen as an arm of the CIA, and because how else could she have known both Kennedy and Oswald? Were you a spy?
No, I wasn't. But the thing that's so funny is that they think I was a spy for the U.S. Well, the U.S. never asked me. The Russians asked me. That's why I was there on $3 a day.
They were trying to lure you in as a spy.
Sure, yeah. But I wouldn't have spied for anybody.
What was your impression of him?
I thought he was lonely and lost and just very unutterably young.
Did you have any sense of, you know, anything bigger than that, anything grander than that?
At the end of our interview, he said to me, I want to give the people of the United States something to think about. Well, that's a little bit grandiose.
So he makes this closing remark to you, and then 4 years later, Your first thought?
I almost knew, but I don't know why. When I heard Lee Harvey, I knew the rest of the name. But I, you know, how many Lee Harveys do you know?
Priscilla says she was in shock, then grief, and then traveled to Texas, where she befriended Marina Oswald and her daughter June, who would live for a while with Priscilla in Cambridge. Priscilla devoted the next years of her life to investigating the assassination, writing one of the definitive books of the genre, Marina and Lee.
I felt guilty because I'd known Kennedy and I'd strung him along all those years, maybe four. And the thing that I remembered best about him was that he was curious about everything and he was always asking me questions. So naturally I thought he'd want to know why somebody who didn't even know him hated him enough to shoot him. And so that's what I was after. I wanted to find out for him, for his sake, why he was killed.
Are you saying that your intense interest in all the research that you'd done, all the work that you did, the testimony before the Warren Commission, all your sort of immersion in this whole topic, are you saying that it's in large part because of a commitment that you felt to Jack Kennedy?
Yeah. That sounds a little bit grandiose, but I really wanted to explain to him why he died. Yeah. A lot of the time when I saw him, he was in the hospital for ruptured and crippled in New York, and I knew that he had Addison's disease, and I really grieved over it, although I was trying to cheer him up. And so I saw him fighting for his life, and I knew that his life probably wasn't going to be long. As of the mid-50s, that was the state of treatment for Addison's disease. But I did want to explain to him why he died.
Do you ever find yourself struck by this sort of notion that that he was killed by someone you knew?
Well, I'm struck by how somebody quite small and insignificant, perhaps I put the word in quotes, was able to cut down somebody who had sacrificed and worked so hard to be president at the contingency of history. Marxism, which Oswald said he believed in, claimed that the individual didn't matter in history, and yet he proved that the individual does matter. I have wondered how our history would have been different if it weren't for Oswald. Yes, I wish Kennedy had lived out his time because he surely would have done some good things.
Priscilla McMillan of Cambridge, Massachusetts. Her book about the Kennedy assassination is called Marina and Lee.
I think it's a sad time for everybody who remembers those events, and it came pretty close to me, and I feel bad about it.
And where were you on November 22nd, 1963?
I was in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I heard the news from a friend, and I was just angry at the friend. Don't tell me that, you know, and I couldn't believe it.
Here is a special bulletin from Dallas, Texas. Three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade today in downtown Dallas, Texas. This is ABC Radio.
I was in the fifth grade, and I was in my fifth grade class, and the teacher told us, and everybody was very, very upset. For a 10-year-old, it was pretty traumatic.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
So at the time, I was a student at Polytechnic Institute of Brooklyn. I had, I think, finished up some class and gone into the sort of greasy spoon restaurant to start to buy my sandwich. And I looked up, and there was a TV up there, and then I saw some news flash about his being shot.
Mrs. Kennedy jumped up and grabbed Mr. Kennedy. She called, "Oh, no." The motorcade sped on.
United Press says that the wounds for President Kennedy perhaps could be fatal.
As soon as I saw that, I was in a fraternity which was next door. So then I went up, ran upstairs, and everyone was glued to the TV and just stunned, absolutely stunned, horrified.
We do not know what his condition is, but the report is that the president is dead. This is not confirmed.
It was
this
just one of those things that seemed impossible, that you could have your president just be gone instantly like that.
Ladies and gentlemen, the president of the United States is dead. John F. Kennedy has died of the wounds received in an assassination in Dallas less than an hour ago.
I guess up until then, I always felt safe and secure and nothing bad could happen. I imagine it's something like people feel about 9/11 right now. You know, how could that be?
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a press report over the wires. We hope that it is unconfirmed, but we have to doubt it, that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination. We will play the funeral march from Beethoven's Third Symphony.
Conductor Eric Leinsdorf at Boston's Symphony Hall, 40 years ago tomorrow. This is from the second movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 3, performed by the Cleveland Orchestra.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
The federal government maps out a plan to deal with the problem of autism.
And rock critic Tim Riley looks at Let It Be, Naked from the Beatles.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.